Disc 5.
For good measure, he removed a piece of junk mail, then closed the door to the box, wadded up the mail, and threw it in the wastebasket. Barr and two others waited patiently in a van in the parking lot, sipping coffee and videoing every postal customer. They were 70 yards away from the box. Their handheld receiver beeped with the faint signal from the envelope. A diverse group came and went with the flow. A black female in a short brown dress, a white male with a beard and leather jacket, a white female in a jogging suit, a black male in jeans, all agents of the CIA, all watching the box without a clue about who wrote the letter or where it was going. Their job was simply to find the person who'd rented the box. They found him after lunch. Trevor drank his lunch at Pete's, but only two beers. Cold drafts with salty peanuts from the community bowl, consumed while losing $50 on a dog sled race in Calgary. Back at the office, he napped for an hour, snoring so loudly his long-suffering secretary finally had to close his door. She slammed it, actually, but not loud enough to wake him. Dreaming of sailboats, he made his trek to the post office, this time choosing to walk because the day was beautiful, he had nothing better to do, and his head needed clearing. He was delighted to find four of the little treasures angled neatly in Aladdin North's box. He placed them carefully in the pocket of his well-worn seersucker jacket, straightened his bow tie, and ambled forth, certain that another payday was fast approaching. He'd never been tempted to read the letters. Let the brethren do the dirty work. He could keep his hands clean, shuttle the mail, rake his third off the top. And besides, Spicer would kill him if he delivered mail that had been tampered with. Seven agents watched him stroll back to his office. Teddy was napping in his wheelchair when DeVille entered. York had gone home. It was after 10 p.m. York had a wife. Teddy did not. DeVille delivered his narrative while referring to pages of scribbled notes. The letter was removed from the box at 1:50 p.m. by a local lawyer named Trevor Carson. We followed him to his office in Neptune Beach, where he stayed for 80 minutes. It's a small one-man office, one secretary, not a lot of clients. Carson is a small-timer along the beaches, does divorces, real estate, two-bit stuff. He's 48, divorced at least twice, native of Pennsylvania, college at Furman, law school at Florida State. Got his license suspended 11 years ago for commingling client funds, then got it back. All right, Teddy said. At 3:30, he left his office, drove an hour to the federal prison at Trumbull, Florida, took the letters with him. We followed but lost the signal when he entered the prison. Since then, we've gathered some information about Trumbull. It's a minimum security prison, commonly referred to as a camp. No walls or fences, very low-risk inmates. 1,000 of them at Trumbull. According to a source within the Bureau of Prisons here in Washington, Carson visits all the time. No other lawyer, no other person visits as much as Carson. Up until a month ago, he went once a week, and now it's at least 3 times a week, sometimes 4. All visits are official attorney-client conferences. Who is his client? It's not Ricky. He is the attorney of record for 3 judges. 3 judges? Yes. 3 judges in prison? That's right. They call themselves the Brethren. Teddy closed his eyes and rubbed his temples. DeVille let things sink in for a moment, then continued. Carson was in the prison for 54 minutes, and when he exited, we could not pick up the signal from the envelope. By this time, we were parked next to his car. He walked within 5 feet of our receiver, and we're certain he did not have the letter. We followed him back to Jacksonville, back to the beaches. He parked near a place called Pete's Bar and Grill, where he stayed for 3 hours. We searched his car, found his briefcase, and inside there were 8 letters addressed to various men all over the country. All letters were outbound from the prison, None were inbound. Evidently, Carson shuttles mail back and forth to his clients. As of 30 minutes ago, he was still in the bar, quite drunk, betting on college basketball games. A loser. Very much so. The loser staggered out of Pete's after the second overtime of a game on the West Coast. Spicer had picked 3 out of 4 winners. Trevor had dutifully followed suit and was up $1,000 for the night. Drunk as he was smart enough not to drive. His DUI 3 years earlier was still a painful memory, and besides, the damned cops were all over the place. The restaurants and bars around the Sea Turtle Inn attracted the young and restless, thus the cops. Walking was a challenge, though. He made it well enough to his office, a straight shot south, past the quiet little summer rentals and retirement cottages, all dark and tucked in for the night. He carried his briefcase with the letters from Trumbull. He pressed onward, searching for his house. He crossed the street for no reason and half a block later recrossed it. There was no traffic. When he began to circle back, he came within 20 yards of an agent who ducked behind a parked car. The silent army watched him, suddenly fearful that the drunken fool might stumble into one of them. At some point, he gave up and managed to find his office again. He rattled keys on the front steps, dropped his briefcase and forgot about it, and less than a minute after opening the door, he was at his desk, sprawled in his swivel rocker, fast asleep, the front door half open. The back door had been unlocked throughout the night. Following orders from Langley, Barr and company had entered the office and wired everything. There was no alarm system, no locks on the windows, nothing of value to attract thievery in the first place. Tapping the phones and bugging the walls had been an easy task, made so by the obvious fact that no one on the outside observed anything on the inside of the offices of L. Trevor Carson, attorney and counselor at law. The briefcase was emptied, its contents catalogued at Langley's instructions. Langley wanted a precise record of the letters the lawyer had taken from Trumbull. When everything had been inspected and photographed, it was placed in the hallway near his office. The snoring was impressive and uninterrupted. Shortly before 2 a.m., Barr managed to start the Beetle parked near Pete's. He drove it down the empty street and left it innocently on the curb in front of the law office, so that the drunk would rub his eyes in a few hours and pat himself on the back for such a nice job of driving. Or maybe he would shrink in horror at the thought of having driven while intoxicated once again. Either way, they'd be listening. Chapter 16. 37 hours before the polls opened in Virginia and Washington, the president appeared live on national television to announce that he had ordered an air attack in and around the Tunisian city of Tala. The Yidal terrorist unit was believed to train there, in a well-stocked compound on the edge of town. And so the country became glued to yet another mini-war, one of push buttons and smart bombs, and retired generals on CNN prattling on about this strategy or that. It was dark in Tunisia, thus no footage. The retired generals and their clueless interviewers did a lot of guessing and waiting. Waiting for sunlight, so the smoke and rubble could be broadcast to a jaded nation. But Yidal had its sources, most likely the Israelis. The compound was empty when the smart bombs dropped in from nowhere. They hit their targets, shook the desert, destroyed the compound, but killed not a single terrorist. A couple strayed, however, one venturing into the center of Tala where it hit a hospital. Another hit a small house where a family of 7 was fast asleep. Fortunately, they never knew what happened. Tunisian television was quick to cover the burning hospital, and at daybreak on the East Coast, the country learned that the smart bombs weren't so smart after all. At least 50 bodies had been recovered, all very innocent civilians. At some point during the early morning, the president developed a sudden, uncharacteristic aversion to reporters and could not be reached for comment. The vice president, a man who'd said plenty when the attack started, was in seclusion with his staff somewhere in Washington. The bodies piled up, the cameras kept rolling, and by mid-morning, world reaction was swift, brutal, and unanimous. The Chinese were threatening war. The French seemed inclined to join them. Even the Brits said the United States was trigger-happy. Since the dead were nothing more than Tunisian peasants, certainly not Americans, the politicians were quick to politicize the debacle. The usual finger-pointing and grandstanding and calls for investigations happened before noon in Washington. And on the campaign circuit, those still in the race took a few moments to reflect on just how ill-fated the mission had been. None of them would have engaged in such desperate retaliation without better intelligence. None but the vice president, who was still in seclusion. As the bodies were being counted, not a single candidate thought the raid was worthy of the risks. All condemned the president. But it was Aaron Lake who attracted the most attention. He found it difficult to move without tripping over cameramen. In a carefully worded statement, he said, without notes, "We are inept. We are helpless. We are feeble. We should be ashamed of our inability to wipe out a ragtag little army of less than 50 cowards. You cannot simply push buttons and run for cover. It takes guts to fight wars on the ground. I have the guts. When I am president, no terrorist with American blood on his hands will be safe. That is my solemn promise." In the fury and chaos of the morning, Lake's words found their mark. Here was a man who meant what he said, who knew precisely what he would do. We wouldn't slaughter innocent peasants if a man with guts were making the decisions. Lake was the man. In the bunker, Teddy weathered another storm. Bad intelligence was blamed for every disaster. When the raids were successful, the pilots and the brave boys on the ground and their commanders and the politicians who sent them into battle got the credit. But when the raids went wrong, as they usually did, the CIA got the blame. He had advised against the attack. The Israelis had a tenuous and very secret agreement with Yidal: don't kill us and we won't kill you. As long as the targets were Americans and an occasional European, then the Israelis would not get involved. Teddy knew this, but it was information he had not shared. 24 hours before the attack, he had advised the president, in writing, that he doubted the terrorists would be in the compound when the bombs arrived. And because of the target's proximity to Tala, there was an excellent chance of collateral damage. Hatley Beach opened the brown envelope without noticing that the right lower corner was somewhat wadded and slightly damaged. He was opening so many personal envelopes these days, he looked only at the return address to see who and where they came from. Nor did he notice the Tampa postmark. He hadn't heard from Al Conyers in several weeks. He read the letter through without stopping and found little if no interest in the fact that Al was using a new laptop. It was perfectly believable that his pen pal had taken a sheet of stationery from the Royal Sonesta in New Orleans and was pecking out the letter at 35,000 feet. "Wonder if he was flying first class," he asked himself. Probably so. They wouldn't have computer hookups back in coach, would they? Al had been in New Orleans on business, stayed at a very nice hotel, then flew first class to his next destination. The brethren were interested in the financial conditions of all their pen pals. Nothing else mattered. After he read the letter, he handed it to Finn Yarber, who was in the process of writing another letter as poor Percy. They were working in the small conference room in the corner of the law library, their table littered with files and mail and a pretty assortment of soft pastel correspondence cards. Spicer was outside at his table, guarding the door and studying point spreads. "Who's Conyers?" Finn asked. Beach was flipping through some files. They kept a neat folder on every pen pal, complete with the letters they received and copies of all letters they'd sent. "Don't know much," Beach said. "Lives in the D.C. area. Fake name, I'm sure. Uses one of those mailbox services. That's his third letter, I think." From the Conyers file, Beach pulled out the first two letters. The one from December 11th read, "Dear Ricky, hello. My name is Al Conyers. I'm in my 50s. I like jazz, old movies, Humphrey Bogart, and I like to read biographies. I don't smoke and don't like people who do. Fun is Chinese takeout, a little wine, a black and white Western with a good friend. Drop me a line. Al Conyers." It was typewritten on plain white paper, the way most of them were at first. Fear was stamped between every line. Fear of getting caught, fear of starting a long-distance relationship with a complete stranger. Every letter of every word was typewritten. He didn't even sign his name. Ricky's first response was the standard letter Beach had written 100 times now. Ricky's 28, in rehab, bad family, rich uncle, etc. And dozens of the same enthusiastic questions. What kind of work do you do? How about your family? Do you like to travel? If Ricky could bare his soul, then he needed something in return. 2 pages of the same crap Beach had been writing for 5 months. He wanted so desperately to simply Xerox the damn thing, but he couldn't. He was forced to personalize each one on nice, pretty paper. And he sent Al the same handsome photo he'd sent to the others. The picture was the bait that hooked almost all of them. 3 weeks passed. On January 9th, Trevor had delivered a second letter from Al Conyers. It was as clean and sterile as the first, probably typed with rubber gloves. "Dear Ricky, I enjoyed your letter. I have to admit I felt sorry for you at first, but you seem to have adjusted well to rehab and know where you're going. I've never had problems with drugs and alcohol, so it's difficult for me to understand. It sounds as though you're getting the best treatment money can buy. You shouldn't be so harsh on your uncle. Think of where you might be if not for him. You ask many questions about me. I'm not ready to discuss a lot of personal matters, but I understand your curiosity. I was married for 30 years, but not anymore. I live in D.C. and work for the government. My job is challenging and fulfilling. I live alone. I have few close friends and prefer it that way. When I travel, it's usually to Asia. I adore Tokyo. I'll keep you in my thoughts in the days to come. Al Conyers." Just above the typewritten name, he'd scribbled the name Al with a black felt pen. Fine point. The letter was most unimpressive, for 3 reasons. First, Conyers did not have a wife, or at least he said he didn't. A wife was crucial for extortion. Threatened to tell the wife to send her copies of all the letters from the gay pen pal, and the money rolled in. Second, Al worked for the government, so he probably didn't have a lot of money. Third, Al was much too scared to waste time with. Getting information was like pulling teeth. The Quince Garbys and Curtis Cateses were much more fun because they'd spent their lives in the closet and were now anxious to escape. Their letters were long and windy and filled with all the damning little facts an extortionist might need. Not Al. Al was boring. Al wasn't sure what he wanted. So Ricky raised the stakes with his second letter, another piece of boilerplate Beach had perfected with practice. Ricky had just learned that he would be released in a few months, and he was from Baltimore. What a coincidence. And he might need some help getting a job. His rich uncle was refusing to help anymore. He was afraid of life on the outside without the help of friends, and he really couldn't trust his old friends because they were still on drugs, etc., etc. The letter went unanswered, and Beach assumed that Al Conyers was frightened by it. Ricky was on his way to Baltimore, just an hour from Washington, and that was too close for Al. While waiting for an answer from Al, the Quince Garby money landed, followed by the wire from Curtis in Dallas, and the brethren found renewed energy in their scam. Ricky wrote Al the letter that was intercepted and analyzed deep inside Langley. Now, suddenly, Al's third letter had a very different tone. Finn Yarber read it twice, then reread the second letter from Al. "Sounds like a different person, doesn't it?" he said. "Yes, it does," Beach said, looking at both letters. "I think the old boy's finally excited about meeting Ricky." "I thought he worked for the government." "Says he does." "Then what's this about having business interests in Baltimore?" "We worked for the government, didn't we?" "Sure. What was your highest salary on the bench?" "When I was Chief Justice, I made $150,000. "I made $140,000. Some of those professional bureaucrats make more than that. Plus, he's not married." "That's a problem." "Yeah. But let's keep pushing. He's got a big job, which means he's got a big boss, lots of colleagues, typical Washington hotshot. We'll find a pressure point somewhere." "What the hell?" Finn said. What the hell, indeed. What was there to lose? So what if they pushed a little too hard and Mr. Al got scared or got mad and decided to throw the letters away? You can't lose what you don't have. Serious money was being made here. It was not a time to be timid. Their aggressive tactics were producing spectacular results. The mail was growing each week, as was their offshore account. Their scam was foolproof because their pen pals lived double lives. Their victims had no one to complain to. Negotiations were quick because the market was ripe. It was still winter in Jacksonville, and because the nights were chilly and the ocean was too cool to swim in, the busy season was a month away. There were hundreds of small rentals available along Neptune Beach and Atlantic Beach, including one almost directly across the street from Trevor. A man from Boston offered $600 cash for 2 months, and the realtor snatched it. The place was furnished with odds and ends no flea market would handle. The old shag carpet was well worn and emitted a permanent musty smell. It was perfect. The renter's first chore was to cover the windows. Three of them faced the street and looked across to Trevor's, and during the first few hours of surveillance, it became obvious how few clients came and went. There was so little business over there. When work surfaced, it was usually done by the secretary, Jan, who also read a lot of magazines. Others quietly moved into the rental, men and women with old suitcases and large duffel bags filled with electronic wizardry. The fragile furnishings were shoved to the rear of the cottage, and the front rooms were quickly filled with screens and monitors and listening devices of a dozen varieties. Trevor himself would make an interesting case study for third-year law students. He arrived around 9 a.m. and spent the first hour reading newspapers. His morning client seemed to always arrive at 10:30, and after an exhaustive half-hour conference, he was ready for lunch, always at Pete's Bar and Grill. He carried a phone with him to prove his importance to the bartenders there, and he usually made two or three unnecessary calls to other lawyers. He called his bookie a lot. Then he walked back to his office, past the rental where the CIA monitored every step, back to his desk where it was time for a nap. He came to life around 3 and hit it hard for 2 hours. By then, he needed another long neck from Pete's. The second time they followed him to Trumbull, he left the prison after an hour and returned to his office about 6 p.m. While he was having dinner in an oyster bar on Atlantic Boulevard alone, an agent entered his office and found his old briefcase. In it were 5 letters from Percy and Ricky. The commander of the silent army in and around Neptune Beach was a man named Klockner, the best Teddy had in the field of domestic street spying. Klockner had been instructed to intercept all mail flowing through the law office. When Trevor went straight home after leaving the oyster bar, the 5 letters were taken across the street to the rental where they were opened, copied, then resealed and replaced in Trevor's briefcase. None of the 5 was for Al Conyers. At Langley, DeVille read the 5 letters as they came off the fax. They were examined by two handwriting experts who agreed that Percy and Ricky were not the same people. Using samples taken from their court files, it was determined without much effort that Percy was really former Justice Finn Yarber and that Ricky was former U.S. District Judge Hatley Beach. Ricky's address was the Aladdin North box at the Neptune Beach post office. Percy, to their surprise, used a postal box in Atlantic Beach, one rented to an outfit called Laurel Ridge. Chapter 17. For his next visit to Langley, the first in 3 weeks, the candidate arrived in a caravan of shiny black vans, all going too fast, but who would complain? They were cleared and waved onward, deeper into the complex, until they roared to a collective stop near a very convenient door where all sorts of grim-faced, thick-necked young men were waiting. Lake rode the wave into the building, losing escorts as he went, until finally he arrived not at the usual bunker, but in Mr. Maynard's formal office, with a view of a small forest. Everyone else was left at the door. Alone, the two great men shook hands warmly and actually appeared happy to see one another. Important things first. "Congratulations on Virginia," Teddy said. Lake shrugged as if he wasn't sure. "Thank you, in more ways than one." "It's a very impressive win, Mr. Lake," Teddy said. "Governor Terry worked hard there for a year. 2 months ago, he had commitments from every precinct captain in the state. He looked unbeatable. Now I think he's fading fast. It's often a disadvantage to be the front runner early in the race." "Momentum is a strange animal in politics," Lake observed wisely. "Cash is even stranger. Right now, Governor Terry can't find a dime because you've got it all. Money follows momentum. I'm sure I'll say this many times, Mr. Maynard, but, well, thanks. You've given me an opportunity I'd hardly dreamed of." "Are you having any fun?" "Not yet. If we win, the fun will come later." "The fun starts next Tuesday, Mr. Lake, with Big Super Tuesday. New York, California, Massachusetts, Ohio, Georgia, Missouri, Maryland, Maine, Connecticut, all in one day. Almost 600 delegates. Teddy's eyes were dancing, as if he could almost count the votes. "And you're ahead in every state, Mr. Lake. Can you believe it?" "No, I cannot." "It's true. You're neck and neck in Maine, for some damned reason, and it's close in California, but you're going to win big next Tuesday." "If you believe the polls," Lake said, as if he didn't trust them himself. Fact was, like every candidate, Lake was addicted to the polls. He was actually gaining in California, a state with 140,000 defense workers. "Oh, I believe them. And I believe that a landslide is coming on Little Super Tuesday. They love you down south, Mr. Lake. They love guns and tough talk and such, and right now they're falling in love with Aaron Lake. Next Tuesday will be fun, but the following Tuesday will be a romp." Teddy Maynard was predicting a romp, and Lake couldn't help but smile. His polls showed the same trends, but it just sounded better coming from Teddy. He lifted a sheet of paper and read the latest polling data from around the country. Lake was ahead by at least 5 points in every state. They reveled in their momentum for a few minutes, then Teddy turned serious. "There's something you should know," he said, and the smile was gone. He flipped a page and glanced at some notes. 2 nights ago, in the Khyber Pass in the mountains in Afghanistan, a Russian long-range missile with nuclear warheads was moved by truck into Pakistan. It is now en route to Iran, where it will be used for God knows what. The missile has a range of 3,000 miles and the capability of delivering 4 nuclear bombs. The price was about $30 million U.S., cash up front paid by the Iranians through a bank in Luxembourg. It's still there, in an account believed to be controlled by Natty Chenkov's people. I thought he was stockpiling, not selling. He needs cash, and he's getting it. In fact, he's probably the only man we know who's collecting it faster than you. Teddy didn't do humor well, but Lake laughed out of politeness anyway. Is the missile operational? Lake asked. We think so. It originated from a collection of silos near Kiev, and we believe it's of a recent make and model. With so many lying around, why would the Iranians buy an old one? Yes, it's safe to assume it's fully operational. Is it the first? There have been some spare parts and plutonium to Iran and Iraq and India and others, but I think this is the first fully assembled, ready-to-shoot missile. Are they anxious to use it? We don't think so. It appears as if the transaction was instigated by Chenkov. He needs the money to buy other kinds of weapons. He's shopping his wares, things he doesn't need. Do the Israelis know it? No, not yet. You have to be careful with them. Everything is give and take. Someday, if we need something from them, then we might tell them about this transaction. For a moment, Lake longed to be president, and immediately, he wanted to know everything Teddy knew. Then he realized he probably never would. There was, after all, a sitting president right then, at that moment, albeit a lame duck, and Teddy wasn't chatting with him about Chenkov and his missiles. "What do the Russians think about my campaign?" he asked. "At first, they weren't concerned. Now they're watching closely. But you have to remember, there is no such thing as a Russian voice anymore. The free marketers speak favorably of you because they fear the communists. The hardliners are scared of you. It's very complex." "And Chenkov?" "I'm ashamed to say we're not that close to him yet, but we're working on it. We should have some ears in the vicinity soon." Teddy tossed his papers onto his desk and rolled himself closer to Lake. The many wrinkles in his forehead pinched closer together, downward. His bushy eyebrows fell hard on his sad eyes. "Listen to me, Mr. Lake," he said, his voice much more somber. "You have this thing won. There will be a bump or two in the road, things we cannot foresee. And even if we could, we'd be powerless to prevent them. We'll ride them out together. The damage will be slight. You're something brand new, and the people like you. You're doing a marvelous job and communicating. Keep the message simple. Our security is at risk. The world is not as safe as it looks. I'll take care of the money, and I'll certainly keep the country frightened. That missile in the Khyber Pass, we could have detonated it. 5,000 people would have been killed, 5,000 Pakistanis, nuclear bombs exploding in the mountains. You think we'd wake up and worry about the stock market? Not a chance. I'll take care of the fear, Mr. Lake. You keep your nose clean and run hard." "I'm running as hard as I can." "Run harder. And no surprises, okay?" "Certainly not." Lake wasn't sure what he meant by surprises, but he let it pass. Just a bit of grandfatherly wisdom, perhaps. Teddy rolled away again. He found his buttons and a screen dropped from the ceiling. They spent 20 minutes viewing rough cuts of the next series of Lake ads, then said their goodbyes. Lake sped away from Langley, two vans in front and one behind, all racing to Reagan National Airport where the jet was waiting. He wanted a quiet night in Georgetown, at home where the world was held at bay, where he could read a book in solitude with no one watching or listening. He longed for the anonymity of the streets, the nameless faces, the Arab baker on M Street who made a perfect bagel, the used book dealer on Wisconsin, the coffee house where they roasted beans from Africa. Would he ever be able to walk the streets again like a normal person, doing whatever he pleased? Something told him no, that those days were gone, probably forever. When Lake was airborne, DeVille entered the bunker and announced to Teddy that Lake had come and gone without trying to check the mailbox. It was time for the daily briefing on the Lake mess. Teddy was spending more time than he'd planned worrying about what his candidate might do next. The five letters Klockner and his group intercepted from Trevor had been thoroughly researched. Two had been written by Yarber as Percy, the other three by Beach as Ricky. The five pen pals were in different states. Four were using fictitious names, one was bold enough not to hide behind an alias. The letters were basically the same. Percy and Ricky were troubled young men in rehab, trying desperately to pull their lives together, both talented and still able to dream big dreams, but in need of moral and physical support from new friends because the old ones were dangerous. They freely divulged their sins and foibles, their weaknesses and heartaches. They rambled about their lives after rehab, their hopes and dreams of all the things they wanted to do. They were proud of their tans and their muscles, and seemed anxious to show their new hardened bodies to their pen pals. Only one letter asked for money. Ricky wanted a loan of $1,000 from a correspondent named Peter in Spokane, Washington. He said the money was needed to cover some expenses his uncle was refusing to pay. Teddy had read the letters more than once. The request for money was important because it began to shed light on the brethren's little game. Perhaps it was just a two-bit enterprise someone taught them, some other con who'd finished his time at Trumbull and was now roaming at large, stealing anew. But the size of the stakes was not the issue. It was a flesh game. Thinner waists and bronze skin and firm biceps, and their candidate was in the middle of it. There were still questions, but Teddy was patient. They would watch the mail. The pieces would fall into place. With Spicer guarding the door to the conference room and daring anyone to use the law library, Beach and Yarber labored away with their mail. To Al Conyers, Beach wrote, "Dear Al, thanks for your last letter. It means so much to me to hear from you. I feel like I've been living in a cage for months and I'm slowly seeing daylight. Your letters help to open the door. Please don't stop writing. I'm sorry if I've bored you with too much personal stuff. I respect your privacy and hope I haven't asked too many questions. You seem like a very sensitive man who enjoys solitude and the finer things of life. I thought about you last night when I watched Key Largo, the old Bogart and Bacall film. I could almost taste the Chinese carryout. The food here is pretty good, I guess, but they simply can't do Chinese. I have a great idea. In 2 months, when I get out of here, let's rent Casablanca and African Queen, get the carryout, get a bottle of non-alcoholic wine, and spend a quiet evening on the sofa. God, I get excited just thinking about life on the outside and doing real things again. Forgive me if I'm going too fast, Al. It's just that I've done without a lot of things here, and not just booze and good food. Know what I mean? The halfway house in Baltimore is willing to take me if I can find a part-time job of some type. You said you had some interests there. I know I'm asking a lot because you don't know me, but can you arrange this? I will be forever grateful. Please write me soon, Al. Your letters and the hopes and dreams of leaving here in 2 months with a job on the outside sustain me in my darkest hours. Thanks, friend. Love, Ricky." The one to Quince Garby had a very different tone. Beach and Yarber had kicked it around for several days. The final draft read, "Dear Quince, your father owns a bank, yet you say you can only raise another $10,000. I think you're lying, Quince, and it really ticks me off. I'm tempted to send the file to your father and wife anyway. I'll settle for $25,000 immediately, same wiring instructions. And don't threaten suicide. I really don't care what you do. We'll never meet, and I think you're a sicko anyway. Wire the damned money, Quince, and now." Love, Ricky. Klockner worried that Trevor might visit Trumbull one day before noon, then drop off the mail at some point along the way before returning to his office or his home. There was no way to intercept it while en route. It was imperative that he haul it back and leave it overnight so they could get their hands on it. He worried, but at the same time, Trevor was proving to be a late starter. He showed few signs of life until after his 2 o'clock nap. So when he informed his secretary that he was about to leave for Trumbull at 11 a.m., the rental across the street sprang into action. A call was immediately placed by a middle-aged woman claiming to be a Mrs. Beltrone, who explained to Jan that she and her rich husband were in dire need of a quick divorce. The secretary put her on hold and yelled down the hallway for Trevor to wait a second. Trevor was gathering papers from his desk and placing them in his briefcase. The camera in the ceiling above him caught his look of displeasure at having been interrupted by a new client.
"She says she's rich!" Jan yelled, and Trevor's frown disappeared.
He sat down and waited. Mrs. Beltrone unloaded on the secretary. She was wife number 3. The husband was much older. They had a home in Jacksonville, but spent most of their time at their home in Bermuda. Also had a home in Vail. They'd been planning the divorce for some time. Everything had been agreed on, no fighting at all, very amicable. Just needed a good lawyer to handle the paperwork. Mr. Carson had come highly recommended, but they had to act fast for some undisclosed reason. Trevor took over and listened to the same story. Mrs. Beltrone was sitting across the street in the rental, working from a script the team had put together just for this occasion. "I really need to see you," she said after 15 minutes of baring her soul. "Well, I'm awfully busy," Trevor said, as if he were flipping pages in half a dozen daily appointment books. Mrs. Beltrone was watching him on the monitor. His feet were on the desk, his eyes closed, his bow tie crooked. The life of an awfully busy lawyer. "Please," she begged, "we need to get this over with. I must see you today." "Where's your husband?"
"He's in France, but he'll be here tomorrow."
"Well, let's see," Trevor mumbled, playing with his bow tie.
"What's your fee?"
she asked, and his eyes flew open. "Well, this is obviously more complicated than your simple no-fault. I'd have to charge a fee of $10,000. He grimaced when he said it, holding his breath for the response.
"I'll bring it today," she said. "Can I see you at 1?
He was on his feet, hovering over the phone. "How about 1:30, he managed to say.
"I'll be there."
"Do you know where my office is?"
"My driver can find it. Thanks, Mr. Carson."
"Just call me Trevor," he almost said, but she was gone. They watched as he wrung his hands together, then pumped his fists, gritted his teeth, said yes. He'd hooked a big one. Jan appeared from the hall and said,
"Well?"
"She'll be here at 1:30. Get this place cleaned up a little."
"I'm not a maid. Can you get some money up front? I need to pay bills."
"I'll get the damned money." Trevor attacked his bookshelves, straightening volumes he hadn't touched in years, dusting the planks with a paper towel, stuffing files in drawers. When he charged his desk, Jan finally felt a twinge of guilt and began vacuuming the reception area. They labored through lunch, their bitching and straining making for great amusement across the street. No sign of Mrs. Beltrone at 1:30.
"Where the hell is she?"
Trevor barked down the hall just after 2.
"Maybe she checked around, got some more references," Jan said.
"What did you say?" he yelled.
"Nothing, boss."
"Call her," he demanded at 2:30.
"She didn't leave a number."
"You didn't get a number?"
"That's not what I said. I said she didn't leave a number."
At 3:30, Trevor stormed out of his office, still trying desperately to uphold his end of a raging argument with a woman he'd fired at least 10 times in the past 8 years. They followed him straight to Trumbull. He was in the prison for 53 minutes, and when he left it, it was after 5, too late to drop off mail in either Neptune Beach or Atlantic Beach. He returned to his office and left his briefcase on his desk. Then, predictably, he went to Pete's for drinks and dinner. Chapter 18. The unit from Langley flew to Des Moines, where the agents rented 2 cars and a van, then drove 40 minutes to Bakers, Iowa. They arrived in the quiet, snowbound little town 2 days before the letter. By the time Quince picked it up at the post office, they knew the names of the postmaster, the mayor, the chief of police, and the short order cook at the pancake house next to the hardware store. But no one in Bakers knew them. They watched Quince hurry to the bank after leaving the post office. 30 minutes later, 2 agents, known only as Chap and Wes, found the corner of the bank where Mr. Garby Jr. did business, and they presented themselves to his secretary as inspectors from the Federal Reserve. They certainly looked official, dark suits, black shoes, short hair, long overcoats, clipped speech, efficient manners. Quince was locked inside and at first seemed unwilling to come out. They impressed upon his secretary the urgency of their visit, and after almost 40 minutes the door opened slightly. Mr. Garby looked as though he'd been crying. He was pale, shaken, unhappy with the prospect of entertaining anyone. But he showed them in anyway, too unnerved to ask for identification. He didn't even catch their names. He sat across the massive desk and looked at the twins facing him. "What can we do for you?" he asked with a very faint smile. "Is the door locked?" Chap asked. "Why, yes, it is." The twins got the impression that most of Mr. Garby's day was spent behind locked doors. "Can anyone hear us?" Wes asked. "No." Quince was even more rattled now. "We're not reserve officials," Chap said. "We lied." Quince wasn't sure if he should be angry or relieved or even more frightened. So he just sat there for a second, mouth open, frozen, waiting to be shot. "It's a long story," Wes said. "You've got 5 minutes. Actually, we have as long as we want." "This is my office. Get out." "Not so fast. We know some things."
"I'll call security."
"No, you won't."
"We've seen the letter," Chap said. "The one you just got from the post office."
"I picked up several,
but only one from Ricky."
Quince's shoulders sagged. His eyes closed slowly. Then they opened again and looked at the tormentors in total, absolute defeat.
"Who are you?" he mumbled.
"We're not enemies."
"You're working for him, aren't you?"
"Him?
Ricky, or whoever the hell he is."
"No," Wes said. "He's our enemy, too. Let's just say that we have a client who's in the same boat you're in, more or less. We've been hired to protect him." Chap pulled a thick envelope from his coat pocket and tossed it on the desk.
"There's $25,000 cash. Send it to Ricky."
Quince stared at the envelope, his mouth wide open. His poor brain was choked with so many thoughts he was dizzy. So he closed his eyes again and squinted fiercely in a vain effort to organize things. Forget the question of who they were. How did they read the letter? Why were they offering him money? How much did they know? He sure as hell couldn't trust them.
"The money's yours," Wes said. "In return, we need some information." "Who is Ricky?" Quince asked, his eyes barely open.
"What do you know about him?" Chap asked.
"His name's not Ricky."
"True."
"He's in prison."
"True," Chap said again.
"Says he has a wife and children."
"Partially true. The wife is now an ex-wife. The children are still his."
"Says they're destitute and that's why he's scamming people."
"Not exactly. His wife is quite wealthy and his children have followed the money.
We're not sure why he's scamming people.
But we'd like to stop him, Chap added. We need your help.
Quince suddenly realized that for the first time in his life, in all of his 51 years, he was sitting in the presence of two living, breathing people who knew he was a homosexual. The knowledge terrified him. For a second he wanted to deny it, to concoct some story of how he came to know Ricky. But invention failed him. He was too scared to be inspired. Then he realized that these two, whoever they were, could ruin him. They knew his little secret, and they had the power to wreck his life. And they were offering $25,000 cash? Poor Quince covered his eyes with his knuckles and said, "What do you want?" Chap and Wes thought he was about to cry. They didn't particularly care, but there was no need for it.
"Here's the deal, Mr. Garby," said Chap. "You take the money lying there on your desk, and you tell us everything about Ricky. Show us your letters, show us everything. If you have a file or a box or some secret place where you've hidden everything, we'd like to see it. Once we've gathered all we need, then we'll leave. We'll disappear as quickly as we've come, and you'll never know who we are or who we're protecting."
"And you'll keep the secrets?"
"Absolutely.
There's no reason for us to tell anyone about you," Wes added.
"Can you make him stop?" Quince asked, staring at them.
Chap and Wes paused and glanced at each other. Their responses had been perfect so far, but this question had no clear answer.
"We can't promise, Mr. Garby," Wes said, "but we'll try our best to put this Ricky character out of business. As we said, he's upsetting our client, too."
"You've got to protect me on this."
"We'll do all we can."
Suddenly, Quince stood and leaned forward with his palms flat on the desk.
"Then I have no choice," he announced.
He didn't touch the money, but walked a few steps to an ancient glass bookcase filled with weathered and peeling volumes. With one key, he unlocked the case, and with another he opened a small hidden safe on the second shelf from the floor. Carefully, he withdrew a thin, letter-sized folder, which he delicately placed next to the envelope filled with cash. Just as he opened the file, an offensive, high-pitched voice squawked through the intercom.
"Mr. Garby, your father would like to see you immediately."
Quince bolted upright in horror, his cheeks instantly pale, his face contorted in panic.
Tell him I'm in a meeting," he said, trying to sound reassuring but coming off as a hopeless liar.
"You tell him," she said, and the intercom clicked.
"Excuse me," he said, actually trying to smile.
He picked up the receiver, punched three numbers, and turned his back on Wes and Chap so that maybe they wouldn't hear.
"Dad, it's me. What's up?" he said, head low.
A long pause as the old man filled his ear. Then,
No, they're not from the Federal Reserve. They're lawyers from Des Moines. They represent the family of an old college buddy of mine, that's all."
A shorter pause.
Franklin Delaney, you don't remember him. He died 4 months ago, without a will. A big mess.
"No, Dad, it has nothing to do with the bank."
He hung up. Not a bad piece of lying. The door was locked. That's all that mattered.
Wes and Chap stood and moved in tandem to the edge of the desk, where they leaned forward together as Quince opened the file. The first thing they noticed was the photo, paperclipped to the inside flap. Wes gently removed it and said, "Is this supposed to be Ricky?"
"That's him," Quince said, ashamed but determined to get through it.
"A nice-looking young man," Chap said, as if they were staring at a Playboy centerfold. All three were immediately uncomfortable.
"You know who Ricky is, don't you?" Quince asked.
"Yes."
"Then tell me."
"No, it's not part of the deal."
"Why can't you tell me? I'm giving you everything you want."
"That's not what we agreed on."
"I want to kill the bastard."
"Relax, Mr. Garby. We have a deal. You get the money, we get the file, nobody gets hurt." Let's go back to the beginning, Chap said, looking down at the fragile and suffering little man in the oversized chair. How did it all start? Quince moved some papers around in the file and produced a thin magazine. I bought this at a bookstore in Chicago, he said, sliding it around so they could read it. The title was Out and About, and it described itself as a publication for mature men with alternative lifestyles. He let them take in the cover, then flipped to the back pages. Wes and Chap didn't try to touch it, but their eyes took in as much as possible. Very few pictures, lots of small print. It wasn't pornography by any means. On page 46 was a small section of personals. One was circled with a red pen. It read, SWM in 20s looking for kind and discreet gentlemen in 40s or 50s to pen pal with. Wes and Chap leaned lower to read it, then came back up together. So you answered this ad? Chap said. I did. I sent a little note, and about 2 weeks later I heard from Ricky. Do you have a copy of your note? No. I didn't copy my letters. Nothing left this office. I was afraid to make copies around here. Wes and Chap frowned in disbelief, then great disappointment. What kind of dumbass were they dealing with here? Sorry, Quince said, tempted to grab the cash before they changed their minds. Moving things along, he removed the first letter from Ricky and thrust it at them. Just lay it down, Wes said, and they leaned in again, inspecting without touching. They were very slow readers, Quince noticed, and they read with incredible concentration. His mind was beginning to clear, and a glimmer of hope emerged. How sweet it was to have the money and not have to worry about another crooked loan, another pack of lies to cover his trail. And now he had allies, Wes and Chap here, and God knows who else working against Ricky. His heart slowed a little, and his breathing was not as labored. The next letter, please, Chap said. Quince laid them out in sequence, one beside the other, three lavender in color, one a soft blue, one yellow, all written in the tedious block handwriting of a person with plenty of time. When they finished one page, Chap would carefully arrange the next one with a pair of tweezers. Their fingers touched nothing. The odd thing about the letters, as Chap and Wes would whisper to each other much later, was that they were so thoroughly believable. Ricky was wounded and tortured and in dire need of someone to talk to. He was pitiful and sympathetic. And there was hope, because the worst was over for him, and he would soon be free to pursue new friendships. The writing was superb. After a deafening silence, Quinn said, I need to make a phone call. To whom? It's business. Wes and Chap looked at each other with uncertainty, then nodded. Quince walked with the phone to his credenza and watched Main Street below while talking to another banker. At some point, Wes began making notes, no doubt in preparation for the cross-examination to come. Quince loitered by the bookcase, trying to read a newspaper, trying to ignore the note-taking. He was calm now, thinking as clearly as possible, plotting his next move, the one after these goons left him. Did you send a check for $100,000? Chap asked. I did. Wes, the grimmer faced of the two, glared at him with contempt, as if to say, what a fool. They read some more, took a few notes, whispered and mumbled between themselves. How much money has your client sent? Quince asked, just for the hell of it. Wes got even grimmer and said, we can't say. No surprise to Quince. The boys had no sense of humor. They sat down after an hour, and Quince took his seat in his banker's chair. Just a couple of questions, Chap said, and Quince knew they'd be talking for another hour. How'd you book the gay cruise? It's in the letter there. This thug gave me the name and number of a travel agency in New York. I called and sent a money order. It was easy. Easy? Have you done it before? Are we here to talk about my sex life? No. Then let's stick to the issues, Quince said, like a real ass, and he felt good again. The banker in him boiled for a moment. Then he thought of something he simply couldn't resist. With a straight face, he said, "The cruise is still paid for. You guys want to go?" Fortunately, they laughed. It was a quick flash of humor, then back to business. Chap said, "Did you consider using a pseudonym?" "Yes, of course. It was stupid not to. But I'd never done this before. I thought the guy was legitimate. He's in Florida, I'm in Podunk, Iowa. It never crossed my mind the guy was a fraud." "We'll need copies of all this," Wes said. "That could be a problem."
"Why?"
"Where would you copy it?"
"The bank doesn't have a copier?"
"It does, but you're not copying that file in this bank."
"Then we'll take it to a quick print somewhere."
"This is Baker's. We don't have a quick print."
"Do you have an office supply store?"
"Yes, and the owner owes my bank $80,000. He sits next to me at the Rotary Club. You're not copying it there. I'm not going to be seen with that file."
Chap and Wes looked at each other, then at Quince. Wes said, "Okay, look. I'll stay here with you. Chap will take the file and find a copier."
"Where?"
"The drugstore," Wes said.
"You found the drugstore?"
"Sure, we needed some tweezers."
"That copier's 20 years old."
"No, they have a new one."
"You must be careful, okay? The pharmacist is my secretary's second cousin. This is a very small town."
Chap took the file and walked to the door. It clicked loudly when he unlocked it, and when he stepped through, he was immediately under scrutiny. The secretary's desk was crowded with older women, all busy doing nothing until Chap emerged, and they froze and gawked. Old Mr. Garby was not far away, holding a ledger, pretending to be busy, but himself consumed with curiosity. Chap nodded to them all and eased away, passing as he went virtually every employee of the bank. The door clicked loudly again as Quince locked the damn thing before anyone could barge in. He and Wes chatted awkwardly about this and that for a few minutes, the conversation almost dying at times for lack of common ground. Forbidden sex had brought them together, and they certainly had to avoid that subject. Life in Baker's was of little interest. Quince could ask nothing about Wes's background. Finally, he asked, "What should I say in my letter to Ricky?" Wes warmed to the idea immediately. "Well, I would wait, first of all. Wait a month. Let him sweat. If you hurry back with a response and with the money, he might think it's too easy."
"What if he gets mad?"
"He won't. He has plenty of time, and he wants the money."
"Do you see all his mail?"
"We think we have access to most of it."
Quince was overcome with curiosity. Sitting with a man who now knew his deepest secret, he felt as though he could prod. "How will you stop him?"
And Wes, for no reason he would ever understand, said simply, "We'll probably just kill him." A radiant peace broke out around the eyes of Quince Garby, a warm, calming glow that spread through his tortured countenance. His wrinkles softened, his lips spread into a tiny smile. His inheritance would be safe after all, and when the old man was gone and the money was his, he'd flee this life and live as he pleased.
"How nice," he said softly. "How very nice."
Chap took the file to a motel room where a leased color copier was waiting with other members of the unit. Three sets were made, and 30 minutes later he was back at the bank. Quince inspected his originals. Everything was in order. He carefully relocked the file, then said to his guests, "I think it's time for you to go." They left without shaking hands or the usual goodbyes. What was there to say? A private jet was waiting at the local airport, whose runway was barely long enough. 3 hours after leaving Quince, Chap and Wes reported to Langley. Their mission was a resounding success. A summary of the account in the Geneva Trust Bank was procured, with a bribe of $40,000 to a Bahamian banking official, a man they'd used before. Boomer Realty had a balance of $189,000.
Its lawyer had about $68,000 in his account. The summary listed all the transactions, money wired in, money taken out. DeVille's people were trying desperately to track down the originators of the wires. They knew about Mr. Garby's remitting bank in Des Moines, and they knew that another wire of $100,000 had been sent from a bank in Dallas. They could not, however, find out who'd originated that wire. They were scrambling on many fronts when Teddy summoned DeVille to the bunker. York was with him. The table was covered with copies of Garby's file and copies of the bank summaries. DeVille had never seen his boss so dejected. York, too, had little to say. York was bearing the brunt of the Lake screw-up, though Teddy was blaming himself. "The latest," Teddy said softly. DeVille never sat while in the bunker. "We're still tracking the money. We've made contact with the magazine out and about. It's published in New Haven, a very small outfit, and I'm not sure if we'll be able to penetrate. Our contact in the Bahamas is on retainer, and we'll know if and when any wires are received. We have a unit ready to search Lake's offices on Capitol Hill, but that's a long shot. I'm not optimistic. We have 20 people on the ground in Jacksonville."
"How many of our people are shadowing Lake?"
"We've just gone from 30 to 50.
"He must be watched. We cannot turn our backs. He is not the person we thought he was, and if we lose sight of him for 1 hour, he might mail a letter or buy another magazine."
"We know we're doing the best we can."
"This is our highest domestic priority."
"I know."
"What about planting someone inside the prison?" Teddy asked.
It was a new idea, one hatched by York within the past hour. DeVille rubbed his eyes and chewed his nails for a moment, then said, "I'll go to work on it. We'll have to pull strings we've never pulled before."
"How many prisoners are in the federal system?" York asked.
135,000, give or take," DeVille said.
"Surely we could slip in another, couldn't we?"
"I'll give it a look."
"Do we have contacts at the Bureau of Prisons?"
"It's new territory, but we're working on it. We're using an old friend at Justice. I'm optimistic."
DeVille left them for a while. He'd get called back in an hour or so. York and Teddy would have another checklist of questions and thoughts and errands for him to tend to.
"I don't like the idea of searching his office on Capitol Hill," York said. "It's too risky, and besides, it would take a week. Those guys have a million files."
"I don't like it either," Teddy said softly.
"Let's get our guys and documents to write a letter from Ricky to Lake. We'll wire the envelope, track it, maybe it will lead us to his file."
"That's an excellent idea. Tell DeVille."
York made a note on a pad filled with many other notes, most of which had been scratched through. He scribbled to pass the time, then asked the question he'd been saving. "Will you confront him?"
"Not yet."
"When?"
"Maybe never. Let's gather the intelligence, learn all we can. He seems to be very quiet about his other life. Perhaps it came about after his wife died. Who knows? Maybe he can keep it quiet."
"But he has to know that you know. Otherwise, he might take another chance. If he knows we're always watching, he'll behave himself. Maybe."
"Meanwhile, the world's going to hell. Nuclear arms are bought and sold and sneaked across borders. We're tracking 7 small wars with 3 more on the brink, 12 new terrorist groups last month alone, maniacs in the Middle East building armies and hoarding oil, and we sit here hour after hour plotting against 3 felonious judges who are at this very moment probably playing gin rummy."
"They're not stupid," York said.
"No, but they're clumsy. Their nets have snared the wrong person."
"I guess we picked the wrong person."
"No, they did."
This book is continued on Disc 6.